And welcome once again, folks, to All Things Trek here on TrekRadio.net. I'm Bob.
And I'm Warren.
And we have a special guest today.
Only 13 minutes late this time.
I wasn't going to point that out.
But I feel the need to.
Do you feel shame, Warren? Feel shame?
Especially since we have our special guest. Back on the show once again, we have Kathy Ferguson.
Hi.
Who you may recall was on our show a while back, and was easily our most popular guest.
She was our only guest at the time.
Yeah, we've had more since then. The point isn't that she was our most popular guest at the time. It's that she's been our most popular guest since, you know. And for the relevance, she teaches a class called Political Theory in Star Trek. For those of you who haven't heard the episode that she was in previously, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a show that It's a class that examines political thinking in the context of Star Trek and how Star Trek has used certain philosophers in its episodes and certain schools of thought.
Certain schools of thought, mind you, not all of them.
Well, it's hard to get all of them in one show. But anyway, she also happens to be my maternal unit, so there's that. So I think she's pretty cool.
Don't you think the audience would find that just a little bit strange and biased that perhaps she's not on any other podcast but our own because of that fact?
Specialize.
She makes time for us because she has a very busy schedule.
All the way from Hawaii, too.
True.
So, you know, we got to feel special about that. You folks should feel special about that, that we have her all the way from Hawaii just to talk Star Trek. Well, I mean, maybe not. You were in the town anyway, right? So there we go. Maybe not that special.
I mean, she and let me tell you, she really elevates the show to a higher level of philosophical thought. Because I don't know if anyone's listened to our last episode, we don't usually get that high up in the Tower of Academia.
Well, that's because she's a teacher.
Usually, I'm just yelling.
She's legit.
Usually, I'm just yelling about how this particular alien's disease doesn't make sense, and then she's like, "No, but this is a parallel for Locke's theory, and this is like Plato's allegory of the cave." And I'm like, "All right, the cave."
Oh man, your mom make us look bad one show at a time.
That's how it works.
As I was going, so we have a contest coming up.
Do we?
Really? Yeah.
Okay. Tell me about it.
All right. So
I kind of remember this.
As everyone knows, for the past year, we've been using a particular game's intro song for our intro. I am tired of this. I don't know about you, Warren, but I'm kind of done with that particular intro.
It worked for a while. It had Star in the name of both things.
It did. I was actually just big into StarCraft at the time, so it's just like, yeah, StarCraft! Woo! Yeah. But I'm done with it. So, here's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. I want to, for everybody listening, either in the live stream or in the podcast archive, I'd like you to go ahead and design us up a new intro.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. And the prize for whichever one we decide we want to go ahead and use, that person will receive a $50 Amazon gift card.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Like that?
I'd like to have a $50 Amazon gift card.
Well, you can't enter into the contest, Warren.
Oh, well, that's too bad.
I'm sorry, you can't either,
Kathy. All right.
But anyway, I'm going to write up all the legalese, if you will, and we're going to post up on the website here later on in the week. Actually, well, I guess I say later on my week, mm-hmm. because, this is actually the middle of my work week right now.
True.
But on Tuesday, when this show is put up, I'll go ahead and put up all the legal stuff up there, saying who can enter, who can't enter, what we're looking for exactly. But make sure you check the website, allthingstrek.com, check that out, and make sure that if you want to win a $50 Amazon gift card, you go ahead and enter in your entry. You can do that at allthingstrek@hotmail.com.
So basically what Bob is saying is we want to hear your best Elvis impression. That's what I think. That's what I'm hearing.
I'm not sure those words came out of my mouth.
But that's what you mean. I can read you, Bob, like a book.
Like a book. All right. So, what are we talking about this week?
Well, before we get into what we're talking about this week, I actually have an announcement that I forgot to make, last week, because last week was such a kerfuffle. I actually finally got around to editing and posting the most recent, and I put big quotation marks around recent, episode of Tales from the DMZ, which is the little audio drama that I do on the side.
Yep.
And this one's got music and an intro. And the thing that I learned about this from doing this episode is that I can't do this by myself anymore. I'm not musically inclined, and I'm not entirely sure if the music that I added actually made it better. So I would definitely love to hear some feedback on that, because it sounded a little bit better to me, but I was kind of like, I don't know what other people are going to think of when they hear this music, if it's actually helping or if it's distracting. So if anyone listens to it, I'd love to get some feedback on that. Send us an email saying, Oren, this music was awesome, or Oren, this music is lame, but you're awesome because I have a fragile ego.
You should stay away from our email inbox.
So
you should just not go there.
Anyway, you guys are totally welcome to give that a listen. You can find it on our website, right next to All Things Trek. And speaking of emails, we have an interesting one.
Yes, from Johnny Q.
Yeah, our good friend Johnny Q.
I still want to call him Johnny Quest.
Don't call him that.
Why not?
It's because it's wrong.
Well, I'll let Johnny Q be the judge of that.
All right, but I'm not going to call him that. So anyway, Bob, you want to read this one?
Sure, why not, since it's targeted right at you.
All right.
Hi guys, still listening to episode 45, but again, pausing for a moment. At Oren, I think it says something very interesting about your psyche that you absolutely look down, in episode 44, on the Vidians for their inability to quarantine the phage to the point where you assume they didn't even try, and their self-serving mass murder of others for their own benefit, but somehow you find the clown from The Thaw to be a sympathetic character in episode 45, given that his self-serving serial murder was excusably for his own benefit. So harvesting organs of others to save a dying race is off limits.
I think it's supposed to be is off limits.
I think so too. Race is off limits. Mental and physical torture and killing of a few poor schmucks to benefit a psychotic computer program, no problem. Interesting.
All right. Well,
with the smiley face emoticon at the end.
All right. Well,
cheers, Johnny Q.
Johnny Q, you have discovered my inherent sympathies towards the insane clown agenda. But
I knew it.
All right. So no, really. So here's the thing about it is that, as I recall, and first of all, I think it's very interesting that it says something about Johnny Q that this occurs to him, and instead of waiting until the end of the episode, he like will pause the episode in the middle to like email me about something he thought of from the last episode. But it's interesting that, as I recall, I don't remember passing any moral judgments on the Vidians. I was raising that as a practical issue, is it's like, I always assumed that the phage was supposed to be some kind of genetic breakdown, and that it was something that wasn't a communicable disease. It was just something that happens to them for whatever reason. And it wasn't until Life Science that they revealed it was actually a disease that Vidians can get. That, like, they are not born with it. And it just seems like they could have set up a quarantine. It just seems like that would have been a really obvious solution to this problem. If not a solution, at least a partial solution. And we never saw any evidence that they had ever tried or any explanation as to why that wouldn't work. So that was more of a practical issue than a moral issue.
What's the line that, what was his name?
What was his
Why
name?
Am I forgetting it?
Is it from a Voyager episode, or are we talking about something real?
It's something real.
Something real.
God, why can't I remember his name?
Was he a doctor?
No, he was part of Bush's, like, cabinet.
Is he still alive?
I'm sure he is.
Is he bigger than a bread box?
Yes, Oren.
You know about Bush's cabinet. Was he a military?
Well, I'll say the quote, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Oh, right. This was in reference to the WMDs.
Right. I mean, putting that part of it aside, I mean, just because we never saw any steps taken for a quarantine doesn't mean they never tried one.
No, but they imply that Life Science does pretty well establish that the non-phage kids are raised in the same environment as the phage kids, which implies the lack of a quarantine. And so maybe, I don't know, maybe a quarantine doesn't work for some reason. Maybe the virus is transmitted via radio waves. I don't know. But it definitely begs the question of...
Man, that virus sucks.
if this is a virus that, like, is infecting and killing an entire species...
Rumsfeld! Donald Rumsfeld! Thank you, RTK142.
Yeah, that's the guy. But, like, if this is a virus that is infecting an entire species... Why they haven't taken the few of their kids that don't have it and put them in, like, a bubble where they can't get it, so that at least there will be some Vidians left.
Well, maybe they had the whole, like, 30 days later thing happen, where they tried to quarantine it and it didn't work.
Yeah, but the difference, well, A, those people are stupid. Zombie quarantines rely on people being idiots in order for them to not work. But also, zombies have, like, you could argue, a will, and will try to break quarantines to get at the people on the other side, whereas the phage doesn't do that. The phage just kills you. So, and we never saw...
Over time.
Yeah, but, like, there's no, like... Like, being infected with the phage does not give you a, like, you know, does not give you a mad desire to go infect other people with the phage. The point is just that a quarantine seems like a really simple solution, and we saw some direct evidence that there isn't one, and it's just a matter of, like, they never should have told us that the disease is something you can catch. If they just left it alone, we would have assumed it was some kind of genetic disorder, and everything would have been okay. As to the clown thing, the reason why I think that episode is interesting is because the clown is a sentient computer program. And as far as I'm concerned, sentient computer programs are people. Or maybe sentient is the wrong word. Maybe it's sapient. But, you know, self-aware computer programs that have the same ability to think and feel that we do. Those are people. I don't care that they're not made of meat. And so I don't think that whenever they... one of the reasons I like Star Trek is, except in the bad episodes, they never take killing lightly. Like, and Kathy and Bob, I think you guys will agree with me on this one. Like, when you have to kill something, that's a serious issue in Star Trek. And in Voyager, in that episode, one of the reasons I really like the Thaw is when they find out that the problem here is that they can't disconnect these people from the program without killing the program that's running it, or, you know, the clown. Keep calling him the clown kind of makes this whole thing sound kind of silly. But, you know, the program, if they disconnect these people, the program will die. So their first thought is, well, can we disconnect these people and save the program at the same time? And they figure out they can't. And so they're not, like, gung-ho about wanting to kill the program, but they eventually realize that's the only way to save all these people, and they make the choice that they're going to. And I think that's the right choice, don't get me wrong, especially considering that the clown is evil and psychotic. But it's still a life form. It still has a right to exist, and they have chosen to ignore that right to save other people. And that's that was the right choice. I'm not saying that they made the wrong choice, but I like that episode because it shows us this dilemma, and then shows us that they are, you know, they're going to take action regardless, but it doesn't just treat it as, oh, we're swatting a fly to save these people. It's not just like, it's not the same as fixing a conduit. You know, it's more, there's more to it than that. And so that's my more in-depth explanation of what I think of the clown.
And I'd like to say Machiavelli would have appreciated that.
Yes, definitely.
Oh, Machiavelli.
See what I'm telling you, philosophy all up in this business.
That's right.
All right.
So
Bob, what are we talking about today?
Well, today we're talking about Star Trek. I'm serious when I just say just Star Trek.
I don't understand.
Okay, so a lot of our previous episodes have dealt with a lot more particular subject matter of Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
I want to actually talk about Star Trek as a franchise. This is what I wanted to talk about today. Or that was my intended goal, anyway, was to talk about Star Trek as a franchise. I wanted to start with the fans.
Fans?
Yes. And there's two denominations I've termed that have come up over the years.
Yeah.
One is Trekkie and one is Trekker.
Uh-huh.
Right? And I actually had a really hard time finding solid definitions for these two. But now that you're here, Kathy, you might actually be able to help.
Well, I mean, Kathy was in the thick of things when these two terms, like, diverged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I do actually remember when people started saying, I'm not a Trekkie, I'm a Trekker.
And what do they mean?
Yeah, I think this was not an elevated distinction. I think this was about saying, I'm really into Star Trek, but I'm not one of those psychotic guys who lives in their parents' basement and thinks you can really beam up. And so it was a way to claim dignity for being a Star Trek fan and distinguish it from people who were so over invested in the show that they didn't have a life.
I mean, basically...
So it's a way of saying I'm a good kind of Star Trek fan, and those guys are the bad kind of Star Trek fan. And that seems kind of silly to me.
Oh, lines of division.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I understand it, the term Trekker came up because Trekkie became an insult.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, saying you were a Trekkie was a bad thing suddenly. But, you know, so they came up with a different word to describe it, which I think is a little silly, personally. Like, you know, I mean, I don't have any problem with the word Trekker. You know, you can call yourself a Trekkie or a Trekker, whatever, as long as you realize that they both just mean Star Trek fan. Like, you know, Trekkie, you know, a person who lives in their basement and thinks Star Trek is real, that's not about being a Trekkie, that's about having mental problems. And has nothing to do with being a Trekkie.
I also think there's a slight political valence to the distinction, but it doesn't make it any better. It just makes it, you can start to see why people do it. In the same sense that people who go around to different places a lot but are critical of the industry of tourism, they'll say, oh, I'm not a tourist, I'm a traveler. But they're doing pretty much the same thing tourists do, right? They're going around and looking at things.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, buying airplane tickets and bus tickets and staying in hotels or B&Bs or hostels. I mean, it's a way to talk about that your attitude toward the thing is better, that it's more elevated, it's more politically complex, it's more educated. And I think that there's a lot of pretension in making those distinctions, because what would really matter in the case of the tourist versus traveler is not whether you think so highly of yourself that you need a more elevated term, but it's what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's and so if it actually would result in different kind of actions, like say you'd be more respectful of the environment of the places you went to, or more respectful of the culture, or less, you know, commodifying of the life forms that you. If you did something different, then it might merit a different word. But if it's just a way of saying I'm better at this than other people without any evidence, then that's just silly.
Huh. All right.
Yeah.
Intriguing.
In the chat room. Where is it? Something interesting came up I wanted to mention. Jesse One mentioned that Shatner made Trekkie a bad thing. And I think they're referring to the Saturday Night Live sketch that Kathy and I were actually talking about on our way.
Get Alive People.
Yeah.
Was that actually Shatner, or was that an actor playing Shatner?
That was Shatner.
So Shatner was actually on Saturday Night Live. I've never seen that either. But that's interesting.
Yeah.
When did that happen? Do we know? Do you remember what the date on that was? Because I don't know. I remember, like, as a little kid, hearing people say Trekker and not Trekkie, and like not being entirely sure. But I knew somehow that being a Trekkie was bad. And this was like in the early 90s. You know, this was one of my formative experiences with divisive name calling. So, you know, that tells you a little bit about my childhood.
No kidding. Holy smokes. All right. So, but what I found in my research anyway, as far as Trekkie versus Trekker, is kind of something we've covered, which is, it seems like the Trekkies are much more involved in like the minutia, more
yes.
so than like a regular fan. And if that's true, then we're totally Trekkies.
Yeah.
Look at our show, Lauren.
I suppose. like I said, I'm opposed to actually giving them any kind of different definition, because I don't think that there is one.
Uh-huh.
But, you know,
And I think that paying attention to the minutiae of the show is important to the interpretation of it. In order to do what I do in my class, I need to show the subtleties of, like, calling something a certain name evokes, like, calling it a certain kind of hemlock on the show where someone, one of the guys who's a philosopher, it's this Voyager, commits suicide.
Mm-hmm.
That's a way to evoke the story of Socrates and the dialogue of the apology. And so the minutiae matter. They're carefully crafted. When the writers were on task and doing their job well, every one of those little references feeds into something bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just arcane, you know, uninteresting information. It's building blocks.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, there's, like, how many kilometers can you transport, a piece of rock? That's a little bit of minutia. How many gigajoules of power do the shields take up? Things like that.
That stuff I know. I know that stuff.
Who would win in a fight, the Enterprise or an Imperial Star Destroyer? Things like that.
Build me models. Build me models, and we'll get to it. So, what is Star Trek?
Well, I want Kathy to answer this one first, because I think that also I'd like her to go back over.
Well, actually, I wanted to answer, and then I wanted you to pick it apart.
Oh, okay.
Is what I wanted to do. The simplest thing I could boil it down to was Star Trek is a science fiction show that uses the crew in various scenarios to mirror our own struggles today.
Mm-hmm.
That was the simplest thing I could think of. If I had to explain Star Trek to somebody that had no inkling of what it was, had never seen other science fiction before, but kind of knew what science fiction was, that's how I would relate it. That was the best way I could figure out how to relate it anyway.
That's way more concise than I could have possibly been.
I really? Think that's good, and I would just add something to it that's kind of implicit but could be brought out, and that is that the way that Star Trek illustrates dilemmas that we have today is by calling on familiar narratives from the history of Western civilization that allow us to think through those problems by giving us models and showing how one way that you can deal with this problem when a tyrannical ruler is grinding his people into misery. Well, one way you can do that is you can have a revolution.
Viva la revolution!
Yeah, exactly. And and then you can switch it and you look at it from the point of view of the tyrant. If you're a tyrant grinding your people into misery and they don't like it, how do you keep it up? And then you've got, well, one way you can do that is make sure they don't communicate with each other. Make sure they don't eat together. That was Aristotle's advice. You want to maintain a tyranny, don't let people eat together.
Mm-hmm.
Because they get to know each other, they build trust, baking bread together, creates community. You don't want that. So I think that,
Is there a specific episode you're referencing on this one?
No, not on the food. But on the general idea of...
It's
of,
learning, Oren.
...of mm-hmm. tyrants and the... You know, there are often tyrants that get challenged. Mm-hmm. And because Star Trek tends to have upbeat resolutions to things, they tend to be overthrown. And so the tyrant's efforts to maintain the tyranny are less significant in the story than the rebel's efforts to overthrow it. Right. And that's part of what another thing I like about Star Trek. I like the idea that optimism is justifiable and that the world can sometimes turn out better than it was before, that things can change for the good. So I like that. But no, Oren, to answer your question, I wasn't thinking of any one particular one about that. I was just thinking of Aristotle and how the tyrants, you know, power doesn't maintain itself without effort. And mm-hmm. so, like Starfleet, one thing I like about Star Trek, among the many, is that Starfleet is often imperfect, and you watch the people in authority struggle to maintain it. So they'll, say, now don't tell anybody this. You know, they'll try to maintain secrecy, which, of course, you would expect in a military-type organization, try mm-hmm. to maintain secrecy. But, of course, it goes against the need of people to share information in order to do their work. And so it's not easy to maintain secrecy. And so I like that they show those tensions, and then they relate them to these bigger questions.
Interesting point actually brought up in the chat room. RTK142, that's a debate I constantly have with one of my friends. She insists people don't want happy endings.
That's interesting.
Well, our buddy Jim, I think, is kind of that way.
No, Jim's whole thing is that the first books that he read were Terry Pratchett books. And Terry Pratchett is awesome, but Terry Pratchett is like, you know, Discworld is like a mockery of fantasy tropes. And so when he sees a traditional fantasy setting, he's like, wait a minute, it's not mocking itself. What's wrong with it? this is something that we determined from talking about. But I think, that's one of the reasons why I really like Star Trek is that, and I'm all about Star Trek having like complicated and gritty problems. Like I like Deep Space Nine, but I really feel that the idea that the Federation is actually a good place to live is really important to Star Trek. Like, I really like the idea that on Earth, I think it was William Shatner has quoted Gene Roddenberry as saying that in the future, I'm going to butcher the quote, but like, there's no...
I think you mean Jonathan Frakes. Jonathan Frakes made this quote.
Yeah, isn't that what I said? Jonathan Frakes...
You said William Shatner.
Okay, sorry. Jonathan Frakes quoted Gene Roddenberry as saying, in the future, there is no need, no greed, and all the kids know how to read, I think is the quote.
Yeah, roughly.
I'm probably butchering it. And part of that quote, the part about there being no greed, I'm not crazy with, because I don't think that human flaws will just disappear, but I like the other two parts. I think that Earth and other Federation planets should be somewhere where you don't have to worry about starving to death. You don't have to worry about being oppressed by your government, or your government, doing like unethical tests on you and things like that. You know, the Federation is a well-governed society, and I really think that's really important, and I think that's one of the reasons why Star Trek is so interesting, because that way when you introduce external problems, we know what the characters are fighting to protect. And that's one of the problems that I have with with other sci-fi shows, is I kind of have to wonder, I have this problem sometimes where it's sort of like, well, I feel like if the characters lose this fight, whatever, they live in a horrible society anyway. It's like, I don't really get a huge feeling that they're fighting to protect something good.
Maybe they're fighting to gain something.
Sometimes they are fighting. Like, you know, I'm all about, flip side, I'm all about characters who are fighting to overthrow a tyrannical government. I love that kind of story. But, you know, In episode, Babylon 5, just to pull one out of the hat, Babylon 5's society is not great. Like, it's got a democracy theory, but it's a democracy that's rife with corruption, and, like, if you're born with psychics, you get shoved into the psychic brigade, and you can't ever leave the psychic brigade, and you get treated like a second-class citizen, and it's got all these problems. And it's sort of like, I mean, I like Babylon 5, but my point is, the point is that sometimes I'm not as engaged in it because I don't feel like the thing they're fighting to protect is so worthwhile.
Klingon Empire, anybody?
Yeah, you know, Klingon Empire.
Zing!
Ba-bam.
Bam! To quote Ezri, you think you should die? Oh, snap. I know you love that.
Oh, well.
that point that Oren just made is relevant to the way I use this in my class, because Western political philosophy is enlivened by a series of what people call utopian philosophers. Plato's Republic was a utopian philosopher.
Yep.
Marx's Communist Manifesto was imagining a utopian community. There's many of those, but those are two of the most commonly read. And utopia is important for political thinking, not because you would ever necessarily realize it, but because it gives you a direction to move in.
Right.
You have a sense of what a little bit more toward that would be better. You know, and so in incremental changes, you need to know which way to go with your incremental changes. So if you have an image, a vision of what a truly just society would look like, then you don't have to think you're ever going to fully get there to try to go in that direction.
Yeah. I just got intellectually owned.
Well, that's what happens when my mom is put on the show. She just comes in and is like, so let me lay down some academic thought on you. And we're like, wow.
Those are things that happen. So, anyway, moving on. I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of what Star Trek is for each of us and kind of how we got into it. Now, me personally, Star Trek was just kind of always a thing. It wasn't a thing where, like, you know, today where I watch something on TV, I go, oh, this is cool, and I keep watching it or so. Like Bob's Burgers, for instance. Oh, my goodness, I love Bob's Burgers. Such an awesome show. I advise everyone watch it.
I tried watching Bob's Burgers. I was not a huge fan.
I don't know who you
are. I've only seen two episodes, so I'll try a couple more and see if it grows on me.
It's so good. Something about the format. But anyway, Star Trek wasn't something I ever had made a conscious choice to like or dislike at first. It was just something that was always on. In my home, that was just there. Yeah. I think my dad had made the conscious choice, you know, whether to watch or not. And I just always remember, just as far as I can remember, having it always on. And one interesting thing that I was thinking about was whether or not I actually liked it because it was on, or because of the aesthetics, or because I liked it just because it was always on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure if that conscious choice ever, you know, took place for me or not.
True.
You know, it's just, it was on, and In one way, I kind of feel like maybe I've been brainwashed to like Star Trek from an early age, maybe at some point. But what I recall, and what I like now a lot about it, is just a lot of the aesthetics, the way the narratives play out, especially since I was raised on TNG. A lot of it was about these characters who were supposed to be, you know, not perfect, mind you, but they were definitely upstanding individuals going out and solving these problems. Like we're talking about, you know, dealing with the Tyrant, for instance, you know, how Kathy was talking about that. But I want to get kind of your thoughts on it. You know, just like, okay. How were you introduced to Star Trek? Was it always on in the home, Kathy, or?
Well, Kathy is, I think, the only one of us who actively sought Star Trek out. I had a similar experience to you. Partially, this is Kathy's fault. It's that, you know,
did you brainwash
by the time
Kathy?
I was around and watching television, Kathy was already into Star Trek a lot, and I was only allowed to watch like 3 television shows, and of them, Star Trek was the best. but by the same token, I do remember almost deciding not to like Star Trek because it was, like, the only thing I had around, and, like, I almost got sick of it, but then I came to my senses. which I think might have been college. I think college might have been what did it. Like, I felt like when I first came to college, it was only, like, 6 years ago now, I liked TNG okay. I didn't really like Voyager or Enterprise, but I was hard-pressed to sort of explain why. And I didn't really know what to think about DS9. I had barely seen it. And I knew... The only thing I knew about DS9 was people kept saying that it was a sitcom in space and that they never went anywhere. And I would sort of repeat that on occasion because I was stupid. But then I actually watched Deep Space Nine all the way through in college. And I was like, oh my god, why haven't I seen this before? Why have I only ever seen TNG?
That's actually really funny, because I kind of had the same experience myself. I actually watched DS9 probably a little sooner than you did, but it was the first conscious choice I had made in regards to watching something that wasn't TNG that was still Star Trek.
Yeah.
Aside from TNG and TOS, which are obviously, you know, available and always on my TV, because that's, you know, what my dad turned on all the time. But DS9, yeah, I watched it, and I instantly fell in love with it. And it wasn't because they were what they were in TNG, which was these upstanding individuals always doing the right thing, but because the show had a lot of different facets to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the endings weren't necessarily all, to kind of quote what was happening in the chat room earlier, all happy endings, but they were realistic endings.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that was maybe a sensibility of maybe some morality or so about getting some sense in that regard for myself just growing up. Not sure, but...
Well, one of the thing about Deep Space Nine that after I watched it, after I watched a lot of the episodes, one of the things I think that I really like about it down at its core is that DS9 shows me this really, really awesome society. I'm not going to say perfect, because no society is perfect. No society will ever be perfect. But this really awesome society, near utopian society, and whereas TNG and even TOS just showed us this utopian society, Deep Space Nine showed us the work that has to go into making it, and the choices, the hard choices you have to make to have that society. Like, you know, in Homefront and Paradise Lost, they decide, okay, having this society that we have is more important than knowing that we are 100% safe from changeling bombs. You know, we have made this...
Changeling bomb.
Well, you know, bombs planted by the Dominion.
Yeah.
They were just like, you know, this society we have built on Earth is important to us, and we are going to do what has to be done to keep it. And in this instance, what that means is not taking over the society with Starfleet and not just filling every part of it with security guys with guns and, you know, and blood scans.
I actually want to tangent really quick into something that was said in the chat room by Najma.
Najma.
Yes, and actually it's in response to something Jesse One said. That's not what I meant. I meant the Federation represents what the USA represents in today's world. Thoughts and opinions on that, especially from you, Kathy.
I think what he means is that, like, the Federation is sort of just represents American values and is like America in space. Mm. And to a certain extent, that is somewhat true. Although, by the same token, I think that represents a very narrow slice of American views. Like, for example, the Federation is atheist. There's no religion in the Federation. A couple of people in the Federation are religious.
There's religious tolerance.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're allowed to be religious if you want, but there's no large religion. Like, there are no organized religions as far as any of us have ever seen.
True.
Only, like, one or two of the characters has ever shown any kind of religious tendency. Like, I think there has only been, like, one Bible quote in all of Star Trek. And, except for the I think TOS had a couple, but in Deep Space Nine, Sisko's dad quotes the Bible once. And that was really weird.
You mean Admiral Cartwright?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Have you heard our theory on this, Kathy? No. So the same actor that plays Admiral Cartwright from Star Trek 4 and Star Trek 6 is Sisko's dad in DS9.
Uh-huh.
So our theory around this, and this ties into the blood test, is that he didn't want to take the blood test because he's Admiral Cartwright and he didn't want to get found out.
You guys are having a little trouble distinguishing your levels of show here.
No, it's cool. Okay. It's cool. He's Admiral Cartwright. Yeah. Admiral Cartwright is Sisko's dad.
He doesn't want anyone to know.
I think this point... here is interesting about how the Federation and the U.S. being comparable or being parallel. And I want to agree in part. I think that to some degree, if it was really true in the original series, where it was clear
yes.
that the Federation was the U.S. and the Klingons were the Russians, right? It was all about the Cold War.
In TOS.
And the Romulans were the Chinese.
Maybe. I hadn't thought of that. But I think there's a subtler way that same thing happens again, and that is in certain norms about how people behave, that Star Trek will push on them a little bit, but they don't go as far as I want them to go because they are hemmed in by the conventional understanding. And here's what I think is the best example, is that when they start to question the idea that everybody's heterosexual, and do sometimes... And they always take what we would see today as a liberal point of view. That is, you know, they don't want to burn them. They try to be open. But they keep grounding it in what political theorists call heteronormativity, the idea that the heterosexual is really the normal
mm-hmm.
and everybody else is not the norm. And so even if you're tolerant of them, you're tolerant of something weird because it's not the norm. And so the heteronormative bias in Star Trek, it comes out in the episode in which Next Generation episode where Riker falls in love with the Janai.
Jinx, you owe me a Coke.
Yeah.
It's very open toward this relationship between Riker and Soren, the Janai, by the way, sharing a name with the philosopher Soren Kierkegaard.
Oh.
Also sharing a name with a guy who would try to blow up a star in Generations.
Right. True. Well, I like Soren Kierkegaard better. But in that episode, when Soren decides that she has a gender, which is her rebellion, right? That's the parallel. That's like it's a coming out narrative. She decides she has
because this gender, society didn't have gender.
Because that society didn't have gender. They considered it primitive, something they had evolved out of. But she decides she has a gender and she falls in love with a man. And that's nobody. Why doesn't she decide she has a gender and fall in love with Dr. Crusher? Why does it need to be heterosexual? You know, they translate gender into the heteronormative.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is an example of where... And I think it's because they're a TV show that's owned by a major corporation, and they push norms a little bit, but then they stop because they just don't want to be too radical.
Yeah, well, I mean, Jonathan Frakes has even said in interviews that he wished that Soren's gender had been a guy.
Mm. Like, interesting.
He thinks that would have made for a better episode.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they had the... Like, you know, they pushed him... Like, about as far as they ever got was when Dax kissed another Trill woman, even though in that episode, the fact that they were both women wasn't the point of the episode at all, but they still got a lot of flack for it. We were on a point originally. Oh, sorry. We're not on a tangent anymore. But I wanted to mention a little bit more about the Federation being the USA in space. Is the other place that it really differs is in the idea of, like, government services, because in the U.S. there is a big, like, group of people, and by group I don't mean they all live in the same place or they all think the same way, but there is a large segment of the population that really feels like it's not the government's place to provide services. And in TNG and in Star Trek, clearly the Federation provides all services. The government is, like, you know, the all-giving hander outer of things. You know,
yeah.
You get everything from the government.
Well, there's no money.
Hooray, yeah. Replicators.
Yeah. So clearly, don't talk to me about replicators.
Replicators ruin
clearly
everything.
Capitalism is not a thing in the Federation.
Right.
So, you know, there's definitely, to a certain extent, one of the things that have, sort of on the flip side of this, it's always amused me how various cultures who make sci-fi shows think that a certain aspect of their culture will, like, survive into the future. And the funniest one I ever found was in Doctor Who. Doctor Who thinks that in the future television licenses will still be a thing. Because in England, you need a license to operate a television, which is basically just another form of tax. It's a tax that they have to pay. But it's a license. It's a television license, which is something that I think only England does. Of all the countries in the entire world, I'm pretty sure England is the only one that has that. But Doctor Who thinks that in the future, everyone will have them. They bring this up a couple of times. They're like, did you pay for your television license?
It sounds like my fishing license I just have that I never go fishing with. All right, so... Moving on. You say there's no such thing as Trekkers?
Huh?
We kind of covered that, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I was just in the notes that I wrote down. I think that was just a short way of me notating that I don't think there's any difference between Trekkies and Trekkers.
Mm-hmm. So, Kathy, I have a question for you.
Yes.
And it's something we kind of covered a little bit last time. Actually, no. When you were on, what was it, almost like 40 episodes ago?
Was it for? Yeah, I think so.
Because you've been on twice before.
It was pretty near the beginning.
Right. Is you actually have made a conscious decision to watch Star Trek, unlike us, who have been brainwashed by Star Trek, mind you. How did you come about with that decision?
Well, it was in college. The original series reruns were on, and this, of course, will date me as having been born before the Earth cooled, but there was one television in the dorm. No one had a TV in their room. And there was one TV in the place called the TV room. And if you wanted to watch TV, you went to the TV room. And Star Trek was what was always on in the TV room. And it became a major social occasion when the show was on. And, of course, it wasn't, you know, there wasn't Netflix or anything. You just had to wait till it came on every Wednesday night at 7 or
no
whatever
Netflix.
It was.
What?
And so...
what is this medieval society you live in?
Yeah, exactly. It was a major social encounter, and it was the first time in my life that I had realized, because I was really young, you know, and had not come from a family that did this sort of thing, had realized that you could talk thoughtfully about the content of a television show, that it was more than just a superficial entertainment, that you could actually look for meaning in it, and you could reflect on it. And I thought that was so interesting that you could even do that.
There wasn't anything else on TV that was like that at the time?
Not in my world. Maybe there was, but not, you know, I mean, I watched...
Outside of the news.
Yeah, well, Big Valley and, you know, Bonanza reruns. I mean, that was, you know, kind of the universe. It didn't seem to encourage reflection. Whereas Star Trek was this great material that could be pondered.
See, what you're saying is that you were taking the first steps towards a bunch of nerds in a room yelling about who's a Cylon. Because that's where we're at now.
And I never went back.
So, you saw a lot of hope then in it as well? Or?
Yeah, I saw that, and I thought that was really important. This was the 1960s. I went to college in 1968, and so it was a really good time to be in college, and there was a lot of upheaval on campuses and a lot of politics that were aimed at ending the Vietnam War, bringing about civil rights, feminism was starting, the counterculture was big, environmentalism was beginning a bit of it. So there were a lot of people who were trying to imagine a better world. And having fiction resources, having the resources of fiction to use to try to think about outside the frame of what you're accustomed to, what else could we do? How else could things be? Mm-hmm. And that really is why I stick with Star Trek and have not found a show that is as good for what I need, which is to teach Western political theory. Star Trek does what Freud calls the uncanny. Star Trek takes something, and I think all science fiction, good science fiction, does this. Star Trek just does it in a way that taps historical narratives. But the uncanny is the familiar inside the strange, or the strange inside the familiar. So the uncanny is that sense you get when you've kind of seen this before, it's familiar, you can recognize it, and yet something's not quite right. Or this is really not quite right, and yet I recognize something. That some combination of recognizing and not recognizing, of being pulled in and being repulsed, is critical to this experience of the uncanny. And I think that in terms of intellectual development, what that experience does is it lets us rethink what we think we know in relationship to this thing that we know we don't know.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
I told you, it's deep. It's way deeper than we ever get, let me tell you.
That's because we're worried about things like the holodeck and the replicator.
It was also just, I want to make a quick note of this on air. It was pointed out in the chat room that England is not the only country that has has television licenses.
Well, I didn't know that.
Someone specifically mentioned Germany and said a number of other European countries have them. So they're not as unique as I thought they were.
Well,
you know, it goes to show. I thought only England had them, so my apologies.
That's right. You'd be sorry to that chat room, Warren. You're always sorry to the chat room, aren't you?
I'm always sorry. I can't avoid being sorry to the chat room. I have opinions.
Or people who send us email.
Hey, I did not apologize to this email. I just clarified. I was just clarifying that I wasn't passing moral judgment on the Badians. I was just talking about it from a practical standpoint.
Like, you still called them idiots and fools.
Well, yeah, that's not a moral judgment. It's just a practical issue.
Okay. All right, so we're going to go to a quick music break. We'll be gone for about 10 minutes or so, and we'll be back. We're going to be talking a little bit about Voyager Enterprise.
Fine.
The future of the franchise is what I want to get into.
The future of the franchise.
That's right.
Okay.
Stick around. You're listening to the podcast and archive of All Things Trek. The music breaks have been cut out due to copyright reasons. If you'd like to hear the music breaks, please tune in live, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern, only on Trek Radio. And we're back here on Trek Radio. This is All Things Trek. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
With Kathy Ferguson.
Hi.
And so there was an interesting, I think it was it Stoney, who was posting Terry Pratchett quotes in the chat room while we were on music break? Yeah, it was totally Stoney. And those are some good quotes. I'm not going to read them because they're long. But it was an interesting discussion in one of the Discworld books that Death has with his granddaughter Susan that I think is cool. It was pretty relevant. And there were also people talking about wanting to be pirates in Star Trek Online. And I'm like, oh, if only. If there were so many things we could do in Star Trek Online.
I have a long list. Some of which I talk about on a podcast UGC. But anyway, so...
Man, I listened to you guys the last broadcast you did, a podcast UGC. You guys sounded so tired. You sounded like you just couldn't deal with any more of Star Trek Online.
We soldier on every week. For a hope for a better world. That's what we do. We're fighting, Oren. We're fighting for a better
world.
We're
fighting the good fight.
We are fighting the good fight, along with many other podcasts that are out there that do Star Trek Online. So, moving on, I want to talk a little bit about things that weren't DS9, TNG, and TOS, things that we grew up with and liked.
But why would we want to talk about other things?
Because this is an equal opportunity podcast. We love some things and we hate some things. So, as many of the listeners know, we're not huge fans of Enterprise or Voyager. Not so much.
Not really.
Not really. Kathy, are you a fan of Voyager or Enterprise?
I am a fan of both.
Really? Please explain. So, well, I may hate you more for it,
yes,
on the show.
Yes, well, this is the kind of thing that makes or in see me as completely, you know, having no standards at all. But
and Mother's Day is tomorrow. Jeez,
it's okay. I'm picking you up for dim sum. All will be forgiven.
One of my mottos in life is there is no bad Star Trek. There's just shades of good, and so I'm quite happy to make distinctions among the better and the less good. But I find it all very much worth watching. I like it because
I'm going to make you go watch Star Trek 5, and we'll see what you have to say about that.
That's just mean.
Because the imagined world that these people are in, not just the larger ideological context that we've been talking about, but the actual, if you think of the Enterprise as a workplace, or DS9 as a workplace, mm-hmm. or the ship, you know, wherever that, whatever it's the setting, as a place of work, and the characters, in addition to being lieutenants and captains and scientists and so forth, they're workers in this place.
I think I would ask for better, like, hazard pay.
It's a great workplace.
Yes.
People have cool experiences. They work with people who are who they can trust. And the relations are not... people are not diminished in their relations. There's no, or at least little, of the kinds of things that people, us, actually do experience in our workplaces a lot of times, like really crappy pay and sexual harassment and racially derogatory comments. And so those things don't happen or don't happen much. So
qualified.
Well, there's always exceptions. I mean, you can build an episode around an exception, right? You can build an episode around somebody breaking that norm and then people have to cope with it.
Yep.
And,
Heaven knows that in, I think it was Hollow Pursuit, I think is the first Barclay episode, Will Riker certainly seemed to take a little bit of, I would say, unprofessional pleasure in all of Barclay's failings.
Yeah, exactly. Like mocking somebody and then...
Oh, yes, Mr. Broccoli.
Yeah, exactly.
Barclay.
Look, okay, that was a mistake. Whereas Riker's just had it out for Barclay. It went beyond Barclay's inability to do his job. Riker just hated Barclay as a person and was, like, going after him. Is what I got the vibe from. But sorry, Gabby, I interrupted you. Go on.
No, I'm kind of done with that point. I find something worthwhile, and one example is the way that the people interact. And another example is the idea that the new can be embraced with enthusiasm. That new is not necessarily dangerous. We don't have to be afraid of what we don't know. I think that's a great message.
I'm afraid of the Voyager episodes I haven't seen, because I watched one recently, and it was the one where violent thoughts were contagious, and this was Torres' fault, and Janeway wasn't going to do anything, because you have to respect local people's laws. And I was like, I'll see some Voyager episodes, I'll fill in my gaps, and then I watched that one, and I was afraid.
It's a lot of the glaring inconsistencies that we have in terms of those characters, how they act from episode to episode, that at least Orin has a lot of issue with, I know. Mm-hmm. Especially Janeway. What was it you said?
I've said a lot of things, okay?
It was in regards to Janeway, and it was a number of episodes ago. It was a number of episodes ago, and you said that Janeway set back women's rights by 7 years.
I'm not actually convinced I ever said that.
You did say that, though.
I do think to a certain extent...
I know, because I quote you on it all the time.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean I said that.
But people, you did say it.
People quote Einstein on a lot of things that he never said. Not that I'm comparing myself to Einstein. But just because we're both Jewish and geniuses doesn't mean we're the same thing.
Whoa now. I'd say things, but your mom's sitting to my left.
I'm not actually Jewish. I never took the test. I kind of think that to a certain extent, in that I feel like Janeway, there are a number of people who I believe unfairly just, they don't, whether they are willing to believe it or not, they don't like the idea of a woman captain. Like, whether they are, some of them are honest enough to just say it, and other ones are just subconsciously uncomfortable with the idea. And I think that, unfortunately, Janeway will forever be associated with what happens when a woman is allowed to be captain. And I put allowed in quotation marks, as many quotation marks as I can. And it's not true. The fact that Janeway being a woman has almost nothing to do with why she's so terrible. And the only reason I qualify it with almost is that I think that the writers were a little bit more afraid to have someone challenge her authority than they would have been if it was a man, because they didn't want to get called out on being sexist. And I think that was a problem for the show, because no one was willing to challenge Janeway's authority, even when she was making very questionable decisions. But I do think that Janeway, just as not being a very good captain, people will now associate that with the one time we had a woman captain in Star Trek, look what happened.
Hmm.
And I think that that is the problem. And that's why I think it's so sad that the first time they were like, let's have a woman be a captain, and then I think she did a really, I think she was just a really badly written captain. And again, I've said this before, I'll say it again, there's nothing to do with Kate Mulgrew. I like Kate Mulgrew just fine. I think she has really good talent when she's used correctly and when she's given a good script. But Janeway's problem is, what it boils down to it, is that Janeway, being the captain, really suffers from the bad writing, because it's her job to execute all these plots. And she has to be the one to drive Voyager into these plots, but the plots are just not very well thought out. So that's why Janeway always comes, very often comes across as being kind of schizophrenic, because in some episodes she's defending the Prime Directive to the point of, like, fanaticism, and then in other episodes she'll break it or, like, go through backflips to figure out a way to get around it. Because in the one episode, it depends on them not wanting to break the Prime Directive, and in the other episode, it depends on them wanting to break the Prime Directive. And it's the same thing with Scorpion, with the Borg. It's like, the logical solution to the Borg would clearly have been to go around and just look for a wormhole or something.
Let's not help one of the mortal enemies of the Federation. Let's not do that.
Because they need to go through Borg space, Janeway just decides it's time to go through Borg space. Because as the captain, she's the one who makes that decision, and they couldn't come up with a good reason for her to make it, so she just did. That's my problem with Janeway. That's why I have occasionally made references to her setting back women's rights in television.
Because,
and I think that it's... and I also think that it's not a coincidence that after we had Janeway, the next two women we had on the show were Hoshi, who screamed at everything and was useless, and T'Pol, who walked around in a cat suit with enormous breasts. I don't think it's a coincidence that those were the two female characters we had after Voyager.
I want to add a different frame on that. I don't know that that's wrong. It may well be a good analysis. But to me, Enterprise, one of the reasons that I find it the least, the weakest of all the series, was that it seemed to me to reflect the more a certain conservatism that may have been in the times.
Huh?
The Enterprise. The,
right.
There was a kind of World War II motif to it, with, you know, the upstanding American leader, that would be Archer, and then his faithful sidekick, you know,
Trip,
and then the mysterious Brit. And it was like the Allies, you know, out to
who
fight
was the mysterious
the,
Brit?
The weapons guy.
Reed,
yeah, the mysterious British guy.
Well, they did have an entire, like, B plot trying to figure out what his favorite food was.
Right.
That's true.
While the ship was being exploded
exactly.
all around them.
And it's pineapple, in case anyone's wondering.
You know, we never actually found out it was pineapple. They just assumed it was pineapple because he was taking, like, anti-allergens.
But he liked the pineapple.
He was jazzed. It was pineapple cake at the end.
Yeah, he did say, that's my favorite. Okay, never mind.
Right,
yeah. I just thought that was a pretty big jump. It's like, he's taking anti-allergens, so this thing must be his favorite food. Like, I mean, I don't have any real allergies that I know of, but...
But in a sense, that episode supports your reading of the subsequent females, because Hoshi was willing to become totally ludicrous in pursuit of this knowledge about what his favorite food was.
While the ship
Why couldn't
is being
they do something else for his birthday? Why does she have to basically put herself in this situation where she thinks she's coming on to him, right? And then that embarrasses her and she has to try to back out of it. These are people you work with. You don't want to mess around with your work relations to find out what his favorite food is.
On a ship far away from home.
Yeah, have a nice party or something. Why do you play his favorite music? This whole idea that the one thing that they could do was to find his food, and that had to be Hoshi's job, and she had to do it in this way that was so goofy.
Just got a quick thought about replacing the idea of the food with music, actually. And that he's allergic to some kind of music. He has to take a medication to listen to a particular kind of music.
That's kind of random, but okay.
I think I'm onto something. I sense a foundry mission in this.
All right. And I just want to make a response to something that Jesse once said in the chat room. He says, Captain Janeway was the epitome of the full frontal assault. I have to get these people home and goddamn everything else. Sometimes. That's my problem with Janeway. If that was Janeway's thing, okay. That's like a character flaw, or not even a character flaw, but that's her character.
Yeah.
But the problem is that sometimes she passes up very obvious and very immediate ways of getting her crew home, not the least of which is in Death Wish, where Q offers to just transport Voyager home if Janeway will just rule in his favor. So she wasn't willing to do that, but she's willing to give the Borg a bunch of weapons to wipe out Species 8472 in order to save them a little bit of time, as opposed to just going home. And you're right, in a later one you say that was the writers. And you're right, that was the writers. They ruined Janeway's character because of how poorly written it was. And again, when I say her character, I don't mean her acting. I mean her character, which is different from the acting. The acting is part of it, but so is the writing. And so that's why I don't like her, is because she's so inconsistent.
Yep.
Oh, I can see that.
Which is different from Archer. Archer is consistently incompetent. whereas Janeway is just inconsistent.
We all know that you think Archer's terrible, because we had a whole episode
about how terrible that episode was. That episode was great.
What did you think of Archer? Because we already kind of got the inkling that you think he's the epitome of how'd you term it? The, like, American hero
like
or so?
Like the American, you know, military leader, the American hero, the guy in the war movie who's, like, if you look at the way they stand, the tall American in the middle, faithful southern sidekick Trip to one side, and the shorter British guy on the other side. You know, it looks like an ad for a World War II movie. I think that there was a certain kind of reach back in at least the imagery of the characters into this really familiar, to me, pretty well-worn narrative strategy that didn't do justice to the sci-fi potential that Enterprise had.
I was just sort of hoping that with Enterprise we would see kind of what we saw in TOS, but more serious, which was a bunch of different people from different nationalities. Obviously, Nuclear Wessels is a little bit of a stretch, but, you know, I mean, on the bridge of TOS, like, just of the characters, you have, like, a guy, obviously Kirk is from Idaho, he's from America, you know, Chekhov is from
Kirk's
Russia.
Iowa. Not
Did I say Idaho?
Idaho?
Yeah. I meant Iowa.
Iowa. One of those high states.
Yeah. But, like, you know, Chekhov is from Russia. Sulu is actually from San Francisco. But he's of Asian descent. Uhura is actually from Africa. I don't remember what country she's supposed to be from, but she's from somewhere in Africa because Swahili is her first language. And, like, you know, Scotty is obviously supposed to be from Scotland, even though he has a somewhat, shall we say, exaggerated Scottish accent. I was expecting to see something more like that, but Enterprise, they're almost all Americans. Even the guy who's from space, Mayweather? Is that right? Yeah, Mayweather. He sounds American, even though he's actually from space. Except for Reed, who is British, and T'Pol, who's a Vulcan. And I was expecting there to be a little bit more of a national mixing on the first Earth spaceship, because it's not an American spaceship, it's an Earth spaceship.
That's a good point.
So that's,
well, maybe that speaks to something about maybe the economics of the world at that time.
Yeah.
You know, maybe things weren't necessarily all together yet for everybody to be able to field personnel to Starfleet.
That was one of the things that I really liked about Babylon 5, was that in Babylon 5, they commented on why everyone on Babylon 5 is American. Or almost everyone. Obviously, I think Ivanova is Russian. But most of them are American. And they're like, the reason for that is because back on Earth, there are still independent countries, and they all have a global government, but not all of them are contributing equally, because America is still the superpower, and so America is fronting most of the cash for the space program, and so they have the majority of the candidates. And that's brought up as an issue. The other countries are like, hey guys, we would like to have more, you know, representation in the space forces. And they bring that up a couple of times in Babylon 5, it's one of the things I really liked about it. And I would have liked to see that in Enterprise.
Apparently, Mayweather is from the New Berlin colony on the moon? No.
Mayweather is a boomer. He was born in space.
Yeah.
I'm positive that's wrong. But I don't know. Okay, I thought I was. Now suddenly I'm not sure. I guess we could check Memory Alpha at some point. But I was pretty sure.
Well, he even comments about how he was conceived in space on the cargo ship.
I was pretty sure that's...
Because you have a lot of quote-unquote... time on your hands.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that in Fortunate Son they made it very clear that Mayweather was born in space. So I don't know.
Yeah. So now that brings me to the JJ verse that we all have.
Why do we want to talk about the JJ verse?
Because it's part of the Star Trek franchise, and really I'd like to hear your mom's take on it, because you
JJ
and I,
will get bored eventually and he'll move on to something else.
We can only hope, right? So have you seen the new Trek movie, the 2008 movie?
Yeah.
What'd you think?
I liked it a lot.
Really?
Yeah, I really liked it a lot.
Please elaborate.
Well, let's see. I like that they found a way to mess with time because it opens up subsequent...
That's the thing I hated about it the most.
Yeah. I think that one of the problems with trying to continue just the logistics of writing stories within a narrative universe that keeps getting longer, you know, because it's got so many episodes that have built up and have built the storyline. And so either you get things like they just randomly ignore the past and suddenly, you know, things happen that don't fit with, you know, people like us who watch them all say, wait a minute, that wouldn't happen. And so that really annoys the fan base and certainly annoys me. Either you ignore the precedent or you become increasingly confined by it. So you can't do this because the previous episode established something contrary and you can't do that. And pretty soon you're just down this little funnel. And so I liked that they blew up the time, the chronology.
Not to mention Vulcan.
And, yeah, that was kind of sad. But,
zing.
Because it's the storytelling possibilities are greater. And I want the story, I want Star Trek to thrive. And so I want good writers to be hired who are able to use the free range of their imagination and still not, and still be within that universe, not have to dump the universe in order to do that. So that's what
And like, I didn't have a problem with the time travel story, but like, the thing about it was, the problem that I had was that one scene where Spock explains that this is an alternate timeline now. I felt that scene was way longer and way more drawn out than it needed to be, and made me feel like they thought I was stupid. Like, I didn't understand what was going on.
Well, remember, the goal anyway, I'm sure, when they make a movie was to make this accessible for everybody.
Right.
So, but at the same time, you know, as JJ has been quoted as saying, right, he didn't want to make it a talkie geek fest or whatever it was.
You know, he's been quoted as saying that. I can't find where he actually said that. I've been trying.
Those words have been spoken by somebody.
I've been desperately searching for the original quote, and I can't find it anywhere.
Right. So a lot of that science and tech was just kind of condensed into just that part of it and was shoved in your face just to be able to explain to everybody, hey, this is what's transpired. It's also a way for us as, you know, Trek fans of the previous stuff, the Prime Universe, if you will, to have at least some idea of what happened in the Prime Universe, to have this all happening in this, you know, alternate universe.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Someone, Stoney, asked a question in the chat room about whether I hate Enterprise or the JJ-verse more. Enterprise. I mean, I don't actually hate the JJ-verse. I think it's fine for a movie. I just don't want it to become the television series because, just as a rule, the two JJ television shows I've seen are Lost and Fringe. And I didn't think either of them was very good, because JJ's idea of how to tell a mystery is to throw a whole bunch of random information on the screen and promise you'll explain it all later. But he can't. He never can, because he just can't do that. And that's what J.J. Abrams thinks a mystery is. And I'm just really terrified of what would happen.
Well, it is mysterious. It's just not a well-constructed narrative.
I'm just terrified what would happen as if J.J. Abrams was given full control of a television series.
Maybe Joss Whedon could do it.
Actually, one of my favorite picks that was actually discussed on G&T, I think, was actually Seth MacFarlane, that was before by Terry Schull.
Well, Seth MacFarlane has said that he would like to do Star Trek, so that one's got a little more relevancy. And I can totally see Seth MacFarlane doing Star Trek. And I'm not against the idea of setting a Star Trek series in the J.J. Abrams universe. I just don't want J.J. Abrams to do it.
Oh, poor guy.
Because, I mean, really...
Right, so follow me. This starship crash lands on a planet, right? And they're on this island.
And then they're ambushed by a wild lens flare. For anyone who doesn't get that reference, J.J. uses a lot of lens flares.
Yeah, he does.
But, okay, so, I mean, I could see a whole lot of people doing it. And, sure, they could do it in the Star Trek, in the J.J. Abrams universe. And I don't have a problem with the ships looking the way they look. I don't have a problem with Vulcan being destroyed. You know, that's, like, I think I had a bit of a problem with that when it happened in the movie. It felt really kind of rushed, and they sort of rode on past it and didn't really acknowledge the severity of the tragedy. But I'm okay with a universe in which that has happened. I just don't want J.J. Abrams to make it, is really what it comes down to.
Well, one thing I think that film did well, I don't know who to credit for it, is I thought the casting was really good. I thought the young Spock...
Zachary Quinto
was fabulous.
Yeah.
The young Uhura was fabulous. The young Kirk was just the right amount of competent and arrogant. I mean, I thought the characters were well cast.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's a good movie. I like it as a movie. It doesn't have what I want in a Star Trek movie, but as a movie, it's fine. And I understand that they don't just make movies specifically for me. and I think that as a movie, it works great. I just don't think it would work very well as a television series because there's not a lot of depth to it.
But there was certainly places that depth could be developed. Interpersonally, there could be a number of ways that, like the rocky relationships. You know, they weren't all smooth. These people weren't like friends forever. They became friends in the original series.
So they hated each other.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, that happens, and that makes people's lives a lot more interesting than just from the dawn of time until today that was always the same.
Everything
right?
was good.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so I like the disruptive elements in the relationships, and that could certainly be developed. And the dilemmas of... being from a planet that is now gone, and how do you then relate to the rest of your species at that point? What are your obligations?
Babies. as many babies as possible.
That would make interesting storylines. I'm not as convinced as Oren that could not be developed into a good series.
Hold on. I totally think it could be developed into a good series, just not by J.J. Abrams.
I see.
It would have to be somebody else. And any television series set in the J.J. Abrams universe is not going to be about Kirk and Spock because a lot of those actors are only movie actors and they will not do television. So mm-hmm. it would have to be about a different ship.
Unless they all decide to suddenly do TV.
Unless they all decide to slum it, I guess.
I suppose my bigger question is, with the expectation that's now been set up with these J.J. movies, with the second one coming out next year, which will have Khan as a bad guy...
I'm not convinced.
Orin's not convinced, but whatever.
I'm just saying, people have been talking about... There have been so many assumptions about this movie that have turned out to be wrong that I'm not going to believe anything until I actually see it.
Until you're sitting in the theater.
And even then, I'm not sure.
After you've watched it, he's like, nope, didn't happen. But my concern is that these expectations, I think, have been set up with this 2009 movie and then what will potentially be this new 2013 movie that J.J. is doing... of what the fans of these new movies will want. Now, yes, there are fans or people who have seen these movies and have become fans of the older television series and have liked that as
yes.
well. Now, what I'm worried about is if these two movies, the second movie does really well, and then Paramount or CBS, I think CBS, if they decide to go ahead and do another series, will that series actually be as good as what we've had in the past with TNG, DS9, TOS, things like that, at least as far as I'm concerned, TOS, TNG, DS9, where it is prompting a dialogue of some sort. There's some sort of social message within that episode, like going back to, like, for instance, Outcast, where it's bringing things like, you know, how do we treat gay people, things like that. You know, we should treat them normally, should we not, you know, things like that. Those are the kinds of things I want out of a Star Trek series because that makes for better storytelling, I think, and much more engaging storytelling when it is dealing with issues that are relevant to our society. Now, is that going to happen, though, is my question. That I pose to you guys.
It could.
Completely...
I mean, ironically, even though I didn't really care for it past the first season, I think Battlestar Galactica gives me hope that it could happen, because Battlestar Galactica was an example of a show that was extremely successful commercially and critically that did deal with a number of modern issues. Modern issues that a lot of shows are afraid to tackle. Battlestar Galactica had an abortion episode. Like, you're not even allowed to say abortion in movies now. Like, even in Juno, they have to say the A word. Because, like, it's such a divisive issue. And, you know, Juno is specifically about a girl who at one point in the movie wonders if she should keep her baby. The fact that, like, Battlestar Galactica is able to have these episodes that do take on modern issues fills me with hope that maybe a new Star Trek show could do the same thing. Although, to be honest, if we were going to set it in the, what's being labeled as the, quote, prime universe... I kind of hope they either set it before the whole JJ thing happens, or, I don't know, I'm not really crazy about the vault, about Romulus being destroyed off-screen by a supernova. Like, you know, one of the advantages of it happening in the JJ universe is we don't have to deal with that storyline, because that storyline will never happen. It's not really a big thing that will be constantly in your face, but I'm just not a huge fan of destroying the Romulan Empire before we got a chance to really see much about them. Because the Romulans, even Deep Space Nine kind of tried, and Nemesis tried really badly, but they tried to develop the Romulans a little bit, but the Romulans just never got a lot of development. And I would be really sad if we had a television series set after the Romulan Empire was wiped out, or not wiped out, but like completely changed forever, before we really got to see what they were like before. You know?
Yeah. Although that would be an opportunity, too, to see where they went. I mean, one of the things that has always fascinated me about Star Trek, and I would want a new one to continue, is the idea that the characters are often not one thing. You know, half Vulcan, half Earth. Or Dax, the two-in-one, you know, the whole Trill idea
of
the host and the symbiote. Or Worf, a Klingon raised by humans. There's all these examples of characters whose internal dialogue and struggle comes from that they are not consistently from one part of life, that they have a many-ness to them, and that makes them really interesting. And it makes their relationships full of fascination. So, you know, like B'Elanna Taurus, part Klingon, part human. So I would like them to continue that, to pick that up, and to run with that as a way of situating characters so that they can call on that diversity within themselves.
Well, first of all, from the chat room, thank you, Mad Dog 000. My mom is cool. So here's an idea. If we were gonna set this in the JJ universe, even though this doesn't entirely make sense, part of the JJ universe is that like there were very few Vulcans not living on Vulcan at the time, which kind of makes sense considering that in the JJ universe the Vulcans seemed like isolationist assholes. They really seemed very dismissive of humans, and
yeah.
Like we didn't see any Vulcans except for that were off the planet, like except Spock. So like maybe in JJ's idea, Vulcans just don't like mixing with non-Vulcans. But so regardless,
well, he might have been just taking a cue off of Enterprise, is what it was.
That's what I think he was doing. I think that the JJ Vulcans are a lot like the Enterprise Vulcans in that.
Or I guess Orci and Kurtzman, who wrote it.
Yeah, they're all just like really. They're all just. Jerks. But regardless, part of the JJ universe plot is that there are very few Vulcans left.
Uh-huh.
So you know what might be interesting is since we know that Vulcans can breed with humans, right? And then you get half Vulcans, and then in theory you would get a quarter Vulcan. What might be interesting is a story about, or at least like a couple episodes about like a Vulcan purist movement who are like, no, Vulcans, you can now only mate with other Vulcans because if we start mating with humans, we'll dilute the bloodline to the point where Vulcans will just be bred out of existence. And I think that would be an interesting story.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had a story like that in a role-playing game that I read one that I played once, except it was with elves.
Mm-hmm.
My explanation for why elves didn't exist anymore in my setting was that they just interbred with humans, and there were so many more humans that eventually elves just bred out of existence.
You would presumably, if in that circumstance, you'd have to have many movements around the maintenance or the recovery of cultural practices, like a keep the Vulcan language going, keep Vulcan art going, whatever that is. Vulcan philosophy. I mean, once a group of people shrinks to the point where they are biologically endangered, then they are culturally endangered too, right? And so that would generate a lot of interesting storylines.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole lot of potential about how to do a storyline set in the JJ universe. Like, there are all kinds of things that could happen, and I'm totally down for a show where they do that. I want someone like, you know, someone who has shown that they are good at doing, like, long-running television shows. You know, ideally, I want Ronald Moore to do it, but I don't think Ronald Moore is interested. I want Ira Stephen Baer to do it, because part of my problem with Battlestar Galactica is that I think Ronald Moore is not really very good at holding an entire series together. I think he's really good at writing individual episodes. But, like, I feel like Battlestar Galactica kind of started to come undone towards the end. Whereas Ira Stephen Baer, who was the guy who made all the important decisions he had the final say in Deep Space Nine, he was a showrunner. I think he showed that he is really good at holding a show together. I would love to see him in charge of another Star Trek show.
I'll go with that.
Assuming he's still interested in doing it, I have no idea if he is.
True. Well, Seth is my pick, personally.
Seth MacFarlane? Yep. I'd be interested to see that, too. I'd also be interested to see another, like, animated series, because I have been watching the animated series recently because my Pathfinder game got canceled and I had nothing to do, so I watched the animated series, and I was like, you know, a lot of these are really not... a lot of them are just badly written, but then there are others where I feel like if they had better animation, they would be okay. Like, for example, there's the episode where Uhura and... what's her name? Nurse Chapel, basically, have to take over the ship because all of the men are being charmed by these, like, space women who have, like, our space sirens, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That episode actually isn't bad. Part of the problem with it is the way that all the characters are drawn. Like, they're like, alright, we're gonna send an all-female security team down to investigate. And it's like, that sounds logical. If all the guys are being affected by this horrible space song, makes sense, right? But then when they actually show us this all-female security team, they're all, like, doing swimsuit poses. And I'm doing a swimsuit pose here for anyone who can't see. And it's like who drew that? Like, who thought that was an appropriate pose for a bunch of security officers? And then, of course, there's also the fact that, like, I think each character only has, like, 4 expressions that they're allowed to show in the animated series. So they're just really goofy-looking. And I'm just wondering that if they took the audio to a lot of these episodes and did them with more modern animation, I think some of them would be pretty good. Not all of them. Some of them are just really terrible. But I think that I think that just looking at Star Trek, I think it would make a decent animated show. I think as long as you did it with, like, not super over-the-top animation, but, like, just competent animation, I think it could work very well. And that would bring down a lot of the budget issues. That's a big part of why studios don't want
to... We could have the Rikers in space.
We could.
Yes! Oh, man!
But, like, the...
I'd watch that show.
I would. I mean, heck, even if they... Like, I would watch a television show based on the Titan novels. There's a lot of things about that. There's a lot of really interesting Star Trek concepts, but the main reason I think why an animated series would work very well is that the biggest obstacle to a Star Trek show is that studios don't want to front the money because sci-fi is so expensive.
Yep.
And I think an animated series would bring down that cost significantly. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that animated series can be produced on a shoestring, but, you know, something more reasonable that you wouldn't just have to, like, pour buckets of money into.
Now, my other question, and this actually goes to, like, studio concerns in actuality,
uh-huh.
and doing the idea of, like, syndication and whatnot. Now, we all remember Star Trek as being on, like, Channel 13 or whatever it is at, like, 8 o'clock on primetime, right? Would that actually work in today's market, you think, at all?
This is actually
kind of more of a broad question, I suppose, because, for example, Game of Thrones Season 2 is out, and it's actually well on its way to being the most pirated show in, like, the U.S.
Yeah.
Ever, right? So do you guys think that maybe Trek would be good to be in syndication and then run its particular hour? Or be available maybe through just Netflix or another streaming service, maybe,
personally,
instead of being on TV?
I think the only reason why we still watch television shows at a certain time is because people are used to doing it that way. And I think that as time goes on, and the people who watch television are people who either grew up with or were early adopters of Netflix, I think the idea of turning on your television at 8 o'clock to watch a show is gone. I think it's just done.
I have a small reservation about that, and that is that the advantage of having a show at a time, and that everybody knows they have to be home at that time, turn on their television at that time to that channel, and sit and watch it. Or they'll miss the first one. Now, they'll see it later, you know, but they missed the first one. It creates an event. And that's part of what creates a viewership. It's part of what creates a kind of gestalt, a presence of something in society, is that there's events. If you can kind of do it anytime, anywhere, anyhow, there's no urgency. There's no sense of, did you see it last night? I think if that event is lost, some other event needs to be created. And an example I have for that is the BBC series Downton Abbey, which is actually on at 8 o'clock on Sunday night.
Uh-huh.
And it's a huge success. And then once it's on at 8 o'clock on Sunday night and some time passes, then it's on Netflix, and then it's reruns, and you can go on their website and watch it for free for a certain period of time. So it's accessible in many more ways than the traditional shows were, but it still has the event. And I think you need something like that.
Well, I think that you could do it as the new episode airs at this time. Because, you know, and part of that's still within the constraint, because, you know, we just finished making it. So the new episode is airing at this time. But I think that beyond that, I think people should be able to just watch the old episodes whenever they want. And I'm not opposed to a pay-per-view style system. I'm definitely not opposed to paying for television. The issue is paying for television and then not being able to watch it because I wasn't home at the right time.
Yeah, like, I don't have cable here in my apartment. All I have is the internet, and I use Netflix because my work life and a lot of the things that I have going on in my life just don't allow me to be able to sit down at, like, 8 o'clock at night and watch that TV show, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Which, you know, unfortunate for them, I suppose, and me, so that's why I just have Netflix.
I think it's funny that our conversation now is starting to mirror the discussion over on Podcast UGC about gated content at Stowe.
Actually, you know, that was flashing through my mind as well. But I think that's a little different. Well, maybe. I don't know.
I mean, so the thing about it is that I agree, Kathy, you're definitely right in that having it air at a certain time for everybody creates, like, you know, a sense of anticipation at an event. So that's why I think that you should have a thing where the new episode is available at this time. Go and watch it. But after a week or so, it goes into the, you know, just the archive of episodes that you can watch. Either by, like, paying them like a monthly fee to access those archives, or by pay-per-view basis. I don't want to pay for cable when I only watch like 1% of the shows on it.
Yeah.
Whereas with Netflix, I watch so much that's on Netflix constantly. That's my thing.
My favorite thing though is that I think Fox is doing this. Or no, HBO I know is doing this, to where you have to have a cable subscription in order to watch anything they have on their website for HBO Go.
Yep, that's the thing.
God, so irritating.
Well, that's the thing about the reason why I think Game of Thrones is so pirated is that not only do you have to have cable to watch it, you have to have HBO, and those are very expensive. And like, this is a massively popular franchise to a bunch of people who probably don't have HBO. Whereas, like, HBO shows before were always popular by like, nature of them being on HBO, like Rome and Deadwood and The Wire. Those are all really good HBO shows. But then you have Game of Thrones, which is this show that is anyone who has read Game of Thrones is going to want to watch it. And most of them aren't going to have HBO. And they're not going to go pay for it just to watch this one show, so they're going to pirate it. Which is why I think there should be an option for them to watch it without paying for all of HBO, but still paying for the show. I think a lot of them would do it if they could.
I'd pay for just a streaming service for HBO.
Totally. I would totally do that.
Because they still have some other good stuff on
like,
there.
Like, the reason why I don't have HBO isn't because I don't want to pay for HBO, it's because I don't want to pay for regular cable. If I could just pay for HBO, I would totally do it.
Yep.
Or if I could just pay for a specific channel, like I would
now,
do it.
Karl Marx would be the political philosopher we would need to explain why this happens as it happens.
Karl Marx could explain a whole lot. Karl Marx has the mightiest of beards.
He does have the mightiest of beards. Well, Kathy, did you have any parting words that you want to give to the audience at all?
No, not really. Just thank you for listening.
How about you, Oren?
You know, I'm trying to think of something else. We've got like 15 minutes left.
So?
I don't know. I think, what are we going to talk about next week?
I don't know. What are we going to talk about next week?
I kind of want to talk about monsters in Star Trek.
Monsters in Star Trek.
I want to talk about Star Trek monsters. Yes, guys?
Have you ever talked about children in Star Trek?
No, but that was something else on my mind.
I would love to do that. I think that there's so much interesting about
right, so
children.
Monsters, right? I thought we were just going to talk about the next
one. As is appropriate for the Mother's Day podcast. Mother's Day.
Well, that would have been today, I suppose, but...
But
so there you go. There's your Mother's Day gift to your mom. Is bring her on the show.
Yeah, that's right. But children are so interesting because often the roles switch in Star Trek, and it's the children who are wise and the adults who need guidance.
Sometimes the children are Wesley Crusher, and then everything is out the window.
And also,
then all bets are off.
But think about it. I know that Wesley isn't your favorite, although I liked him quite well, but Jake and Nog, they're children in the series, or Naomi in Voyager. They're actually children in the actual life space of the characters. And so it worked the best with Sisko, I think, because the writing of the relation between Sisko and Jake was so good.
Ah, yes, the man who designed a ship to avenge his wife. Ah, yes, Mr. Sisko.
My favorite thing about Naomi Wildman is that she is the child with the invisible mom. because, like...
Yeah, we see her in season one or whatever. We don't see her, like, ever again.
Yeah, I don't... Do we ever see Samantha Wildman after Naomi is born?
Uh-huh.
Do we? When?
She interacts with Neelix.
Picks, or it didn't happen.
Because I don't remember seeing her after Naomi was born.
No, I think she was in later. I can't tell you for sure, but I kind of think I've seen her.
Picks, or it didn't happen.
But yeah, we definitely will talk about children at some point. Our 50th episode is going to be about religion in Star Trek, because I'm super excited to talk about religion, let me tell you.
Yes, as you've noted before to me.
Well, you got to deal with, I mean, DS9 is the obvious one, right? Because of the Bajoran spirituality. That's a whole interesting thing.
It is. There are a couple of other ones.
In fact, I have a colleague who teaches a religious studies class, religion in Star Trek.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Oh, man.
And she actually doesn't.
I need to go to your university.
Yeah, clearly I picked the wrong one.
She says she doesn't even use DS9. She says it's too obvious.
Oh, snap. Oh, wow.
Space Catholics too obvious for her?
Yeah. She does the more subtle forms of religion and spirituality in the other series.
Hmm. Intriguing. Well, Kathy, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Oren, do you have any other hateful things you want to say?
No, I'm good.
You're good?
I'm hated out.
The hated out, sweet.
Thanks for the emails. Send us more emails at allthingstrek@hotmail.com.
It's true. And you can also follow us on Twitter at allthingstrek.com. Or not .com. Ha,
no.
Just at allthingstrek.
I need to tweet something. Twitter is so hard for me to remember. I never remember that I need to tweet. It's like, it's like my Twitter feed is so, our Twitter feed is so boring. There's nothing in it.
Well, you know, we could, let's, I don't know.
We'll figure something out.
Do something.
Join us next week when we talk about monsters in Star Trek.